Hello, everyone, and welcome to Four Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comic, manga, and all spin-off products thereof. I'm Andrew, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Rob and Mick.
Hello.
Hello.
So, how are you two doing today?
Well, you and I had an adventure on Monday, didn't we, Andrew?
We certainly did. An adventure that we'll be talking more about as the topic of this week's show, which is in honour of Alita Battle Angel. I think that's what the film's called, right?
The film's called that, but I refuse to call that, so for the purposes of the discussion, I will be referring to it as Battle Angel Alita.
As all right and proper people should.
Yes.
Fine. Gundam Battle Angel is out in cinemas now.
Of course, I'm looking forward to the filmic sequel, which will be Battle Alita Angel.
So today we're going to be talking about, can you make a good live-action version of a manga?
Well,
No, you can't. The end. Show's over. I'll go home now. That was easy.
Actually, if you remember what I said when we left the cinema, after the roller coaster ride of 4DX, please never again.
Yeah.
Was that your first time?
Michaelmas, Prince yes. of Lies, Great Deceiver, suggested that you'd rather go watch Battle Angel Alita in 4D.
Yeah, 4DX.
That chair literally punches you in the spine.
I honestly could not concentrate on the film because for the majority of the film, it felt like, you know that kid who sits behind you in class and just keeps tapping the back of your head during class just to annoy you? It just felt like that was being done to me while I was trying to watch the film. It's a good thing no one was sitting behind me, otherwise I would have flipped.
We saw it 3 days ago and I still have a backache.
Also, my idea of fun does not involve being sprayed by water in the face while I'm watching a film.
To be fair, it only does that when there's blood spatter.
Then, you know, be realistic. If you're going to go for realism, do proper realism.
And that one scene where it's raining and it just slowly drips on your face.
Yeah.
And what was the whole thing with the legs where it's whipping the back of your, you know, whipping your calf muscles? Like, I don't like this. This is just...
I know, right? And like, no matter how much I screamed harder, Daddy, it just didn't pick up.
Well, all right. So remember what it does during blood spatter, right? Bear in mind that the first film I saw in 4DX was Deadpool 2.
Okay, yeah, you would have had it a lot.
God, you would. Sure, that was 4DX, and not just someone with a hose standing next to you.
I can just imagine, just one of the warning things for the 4DX: bring a towel.
Yeah.
Why do we need towels?
So, but 4DX aside, I know where this conversation is likely to go.
Actually, you might not.
I really enjoyed Alita with caveats.
I am actually the same.
Wow.
I think possibly an important point to note is that I did not have any exposure to Alita going into this.
Yep.
Whereas initially I didn't like it, but I think, again, a lot of that is the 4DX, and I've kind of softened my position to, I thought it was a film that was fine that I didn't necessarily like.
And that's fair enough.
Yeah, like, yeah. There's plenty in that I can see. There's good things, and I can see how for other people those things are good enough to forgive all the bad bits.
The things that I found, the caveats that I have, for the most part, it was actually quite a faithful adaptation of the manga.
Yes.
The OVA from 1993 is actually considered the crap adaptation, or the cradaptation, or whatever you want to call it.
Oh. Which I have actually watched that.
Okay, that's considered the crap adaptation.
Probably because it's not that good, to be honest.
It's not, but the reason why it's not very good is actually the same reason why I have these caveats, as Mick said, about the current film. It tries to do too much, and it changes big patches of the story to fit, and they don't quite work. For example, in Battle Angel Alita, for that section of the story.
Actually, Rob, I think you'll find its correct name is Gunnum.
I'm not going to call it Gunnum.
As in Gunnum, they're gonna get him.
Please don't. Don't put it in the same category. Don't put it in the same category as Venom.
I'm sorry, I did, and that's ruined it for me already.
Oh, God.
It's much better than Venom.
Oh, no, because what's Venom's monster called?
It is technically better than Venom.
All I can say is I am not going to sit down and watch Battle Angel Eddie all over again. If you're going to go with the Venom-Gunham combo, I'm going with Battle Angel Eddie.
Anyway, Rob, you were dangerously close to making a point before I stopped you, but I'll let you get to it now.
Yeah, normally it's me derailing, isn't it? The point I was making was, for the majority of the movie, it was actually quite faithful, but it's the inclusion of Hugo that causes the problem. See, Hugo doesn't actually appear in the manga until... this. Spoilers, by the way. Spoilers, spoilers, spoilers. So I'm just...
Oh, yeah, all right. We'll put it blank. We're probably just going to talk spoilers for the whole film, right?
It's difficult to talk about it without spoilers. So we're just going to...
Whatever we do, we're going to spoil either the manga for those uninitiated or we're going to spoil the movie.
Yeah. There are spoilers in this, so you have been warned. But anyway, the inclusion of Hugo is one of the big problems. There are several aspects to the story that just don't fit. The motorball thing doesn't happen until after Hugo's death.
This is one of the huge caveats I've got with this. So, I've only recently been exposed to the manga.
Yeah.
I've read volume 1, 2, and 3. Yeah. And I read them in that order because I've got used to counting now.
Because volume 2 is Hugo, isn't it?
Yes.
And volume 3 is Motorball. And that's, I think, where the problem is. They've tried to cram the first three volumes, which have a lot in them as it is.
Actually, no. In these deluxe editions... Hugo is the second half of the first volume.
Ah, right, yeah.
And Motorball is pretty much all of the second volume.
Yeah, but, I mean, when it was originally being published in the Tankobon editions, it was, volume one was basically the whole Rusty Angel thing, and then it was the fight with Gorishka and everything like that, and her getting the Berserker body.
And I think from my point of view, that is the big caveat that stops me going, it was a great adaptation.
Yeah.
It mixes up too many storylines at once. And I think the problem with that is that they've shot themselves in the foot, because whereas we could have done the Rusty Angel storyline and mixed it with one or other of the other storylines just to pad it. Because as a film, I don't think that would have necessarily worked.
Yeah.
But to mix it, they've robbed themselves of at least two sequels.
The whole Motorball thing should have been its own thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think like one of the first things I said to you after the movie ended, Rob, was just, what the hell was anything that happened?
Yeah.
I was absolutely lost.
One of my big problems with Hugo as a character in the film is that you can't empathise or sympathise with him. He has no reason for any of his actions, whereas... if you read the manga, and they included this in the anime adaptation as well, the whole point of him wanting to go to Tifares, as it's called, or Zaram Zalem, whatever they called it in the movie, the whole point of him wanting to go there was because of his older brother.
To be fair, it's called Zalem in the manga as well.
Yeah, Tifares is what they call it. Its official name, though, I think. But anyway...
Yeah, on the ground, and they go, I want to go there, but it is Tifares.
There's some weird role reversal going on here, Mick.
There is. There really is. You were about to make a salient point, and he's doing the terrible jokes.
Hey, exactly.
I don't know what this world is.
God, do you know what's happened? Because we went to the 4DX, we've swapped minds.
Yes, we got shaken so hard we Freaky Friday'd. Oh, no.
That means we have to go on to 4DX again.
No.
Oh, the horror.
So I think the reason the mixed up storylines annoys me so much, because this is not unusual with comic book adaptations, whether they're manga or just straightforward Western comics, is sometimes there is that tendency to mix up too many storylines. Now, I think... they can get away with it a bit with the more familiar Western stuff.
This is the thing. This is one of the reasons why the inclusion of Motorball and the inclusion of Hugo's storyline it just makes everything a nonsense. Hugo, for example, he has no reason to be ripping off parts to want to go to Zaram or anything like that. He has no reason for it, whereas in the manga and in the anime adaptation, it does actually highlight it was his brother's dream to go there. There are no flying machines.
Yeah.
They were banned. His brother built a hot air balloon, but his wife, his brother's wife, and his brother was basically, and his wife were basically like mother and father to the young Hugo. And so his brother's wife reported him.
It makes Hugo a much more relatable character than whiny wannabe Jonas brother.
Exactly. but it also explains why Shireen turns up and decides to help Alita after Hugo gets killed.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's true. Shireen has, I think, 2 points that I want to bring up. Is that, first of all, Jesus Christ, this movie has 5 villains. That's too many villains. Yep. Lose the villains.
Even yeah. Spider-Man 3 didn't try 5 villains.
Yeah. Yeah,
and the problem is it means that both Shireen and Vector, they don't do anything.
And that again...
And yet, ironically, Vector, in the segment of Alita that's covered in the movie,
yeah,
has more impact than Nova.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Vector in the manga has more impact than Nova.
That's what I mean. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, but Vector's sort of relegated to a sort of bit part player, and yeah, Nova,
the thing that Nova talks through.
Yeah, Nova doesn't appear until much later on in the manga.
That's right.
And made him a telephone.
Yeah,
I don't know what because I've only got up to the volume 3 on these deluxe editions, which I guess is probably volume 6 of the originals.
Yeah.
I've not come across Shireen yet.
Shireen isn't in that bit, but she does appear later on.
I think the miss here for the movie makers is they've kind of missed both audiences by quite a wide margin.
Yeah.
So by mixing up all the storylines, they've made a confusing plot line for anyone who's not familiar with Alita. So they may not then go, which is always the hope with something like this, bringing something like manga into the mainstream. Oh, I enjoyed that movie. I'm going to go back to the source material now and see what else there is. But so they've lost out on that because I guess, and Andrew, you're not as familiar with the manga as Rob and I are.
Yeah, no, I've not read it at all.
And to be fair, you're more, even with that said, you'd be more likely to suss out that source material anyway. But as a mainstream cinema goer, were you left so confused that you thought, actually, if I see that in a bookshop, I'll just walk on by?
Oh, absolutely. Like, this is a film where, basically, the main villain wants to kill Alita for reasons that are never explained. And Alita's whole thing is, she's got a mysterious backstory that sometimes she cares about, but sometimes she just wants to run away with Hugo, and sometimes she just wants to do motorball. And then once you find out about what her backstory is, it's not really that important.
Actually, to be fair, she kind of has that attitude to her backstory in the manga as well. There are times when it's clearly more important to her than others.
Yeah, and I feel like just a lot of the characters, they don't really have any kind of satisfying arc.
No,
like she appears and she's Jennifer Connelly, and then it's like, oh, but she's working with the villains, and then she disappears for most of the film, and then she comes back and she's like, yeah, but no, maybe I'm not going to be a villain, and then she dies.
Yeah. I spent quite a lot of the film sort of rationalising in my own head, go, all right, so that's so-and-so, and that's so-and-so, and that, but wait, they don't do that. Oh, and that doesn't happen. And he's where now? So I think you're going to get that. And I think from the point of view of having all those characters in, I think it's shoehorning characters in a sort of different kind of fan service to what we normally discuss. It's like, all right, these are the beat points of the manga. So if we cram all those in, that'll please the fans of the source material. Whereas I think actually...
include all the cool things that people like.
That's it. And I think what they've actually done there is diluted it so that it's too inaccessible for people who don't know the manga and messes around too much with people for people who do know the manga for it to actually satisfy either side.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because beyond that, it's actually a really accomplished action movie based on a manga.
And there we have one of my biggest problems with it, is that the action, for me, it was too action heavy. It missed out on some of the more important bits that really needed focusing on. The whole father-daughter relationship between Ido and Alita, for example, is nowhere near as developed as it should have been.
No.
And that plays a big part in the story.
And I think I get why they went for the motorball.
Yeah.
I know when we've been talking about this in the past and sort of teasers and trailers have dropped.
Yeah.
It wasn't until they showed a trailer that showed Motorball that you showed any kind of interest in this movie.
Yeah.
You were kind of cult towards it.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, it's a lot better than I expected. If I had to say, of the sci-fi fantasy anime manga adaptations, the ones that have been turned into live-action movies, this is among the better ones.
And I must admit, I enjoyed it far more than I did Valerian.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that famous manga Valerian.
Well, you know, it's still taking a less than mainstream comic book property and put it
I think they are kind of comparable.
Yeah. I went there fully expecting to be disappointed, and I was, but in a completely different way to where I was. I mean, if I'm going to be nitpicky, in some of the action scenes, it felt a bit more like a AAA...
PlayStation game,
Xbox game, yeah.
Yeah, I felt that way with the motorball stuff.
Yeah, but that's partly down to the fact that you had to CGI the character of Alita anyway.
Yeah. As I said to Andrew, I think it was more interesting for me on the basis of what they left out rather than what they put in. I can understand a lot of the decisions, I can understand a lot of the inclusions, and I can understand why it's ended up as a bit of a mess in terms of the story. It's still a spectacle. It's still worth seeing just for the sheer spectacle of it. But I think what they left out, as important as it is, will play a big part in whether the sequel, if there is one, because they haven't confirmed yet, have they?
No, and also, I've heard a little bit, it might not be happening.
Yep.
Because they've spent so much money on this movie and it needs to do astronomically well to make that back.
Yeah.
I think it needs like 500 million or something obscene like that.
Yeah.
The other thing to bear in mind about any possible Alita 2 is that it will be caught up in the Fox Disney
takeover. This is true.
Oh, yeah.
This is true. Anyway, there was one important aspect of this that I wanted to touch on.
It said that Motorball should have been at the end.
No, it's not. It has to do with what this movie actually represents. See, here's the thing, and Mick's already kind of mentioned this. Battle Angel Alita, it used to be a very well-known manga. It was one of the first really popular manga in the West during the early 90s. And when they did the anime adaptation, it's only a two-part OVA, but when they released that in the West, that was received very well. Even though it was a crappy adaptation of the story, it was still well received because it was on the back of Akira and stuff like that, right?
And there was a thirst for what was effectively a very scarce art form.
Yeah, I mean, it fell into that gap between Akira and Ghost in the Shell when it came out, and that's why people really, really took to it. And that's one of the reasons.
Also, a lot of my problems with it were just, it's a thing that came out in the 90s.
Yeah, my point is that everyone had high expectations from Ghost in the Shell, and it did perform actually passing well in countries like Japan, where they weren't bothered by any controversies about whitewashing or anything like that. They basically went, oh, Scarlett Johansson's playing the major in Ghost in the Shell. I'm going to go see that.
And I think we discussed this at the time when Ghost in the Shell came out. I can see why a studio... Because for any of the major Hollywood studios, doing something based on a manga or an anime is a bit of a risk.
Yep.
Potentially. So I can see why they would want to cast someone like Scarlett Johansson or have someone solid like Christoph Waltz as Ido in Alita.
Yeah.
Because they want to guarantee an audience.
Yeah.
Even if it's just Scarlett Johansson fanboys, it's bums on seats, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And like, to be fair, I think the main problem in Ghost of the Shell is not the fact that it's Scarlett Johansson. It's that they weirdly decided to specifically say in the film, oh, yeah, she used to be Japanese, but then we made her Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
Yes.
But that's the thing. On the back of Ghost of the Shell, everything kind of cooled off. They tried to do Dragon Ball and did Dragon Ball Evolution, and everybody hated that. In fact, there were death threats involved. Yeah. When...
And actually, speaking of Dragon Ball Evolution, I feel like, and again, this is just me having seen the OVA, one of the things that worked really well in Battle Angel Lee's favour is just saying, we're just going to take the thing from the anime and put it in the film. Like, we're just going to give Christoph Waltz a big old hammer.
Yeah.
Like, people like weird anime stuff, so give us the weird anime stuff.
And that
Americanize it. Just give him, I don't know, a gun that has the word hammer on it or something.
Yeah, that's one of the strengths of it. I mean, the whole thing with the fingers, for example, it's a weird weapon to have. It didn't work that way in the manga, but it's fine. One of my little gripes was that whole holier-than-thou attitude that they gave her, though, because that's not really her character.
I mean, she's just a bit of a brat, really, wasn't she?
Well, the thing is, it's not in her character. She was basically a super soldier, and a super soldier isn't the type of character, unless they're Captain America, who stands there and goes, I will not stand by in the presence of evil. I'm like, what kind of nonsense is this?
I mean... To be fair, in the manga, there is a little bit of righteous indignation when she thinks that Ido's a killer.
Yeah.
Is murdering people.
I did not think for any minute that Christoph Waltz would bring Ido to life successfully, but he really did.
No, I love the casting of Christoph Waltz as Ido. He really worked.
I
really like him as a character, but also... How is he not dead? Christoph Waltz with just a big hammer fighting like 8-foot-tall robot men.
Because it's a rocket hammer.
Yeah. But he's also like 70.
Yeah, he might be...
The whole dreams of a trained warrior.
He might be...
Flailing about with his rocket pickaxe.
I think I have the answer to your question. Because comics.
Yeah, because comics.
The name Alita. Oh, it was my daughter's name. No, it wasn't. Do you remember what was originally called Alita?
I think that's part of the westernization of the whole thing, isn't it?
Not even so much westernization, I would just say improving. Because it's his friggin' cat in the manga.
Yes, it is. And not only that, his cat was a boy. Alita is a boy's name.
But hey, because comics, right?
Yeah, well, in this case, because manga. But
well, yeah.
Like I was saying, though, what Alita represents is, I think, more important than what it actually is. What it represents is the potential for more unknown, or relatively unknown nowadays, manga and anime to be looked at seriously by Hollywood. Ghost in the Shell was there, didn't really perform well, but its presence was noticed. And Battle Angel Alita, again, its presence has definitely been noticed. There has been a very positive reception to it by fans and by people, by cinema goers. Critics don't like it, but then again, critics wouldn't go to the toilet properly.
Bad film.
I mean, don't tell anybody on Cinema Eclectica this, but what are critics know, right?
Well, this is the thing. You go to the movies for a
screen. About how to actually structure a film.
Yes. Okay.
And deliver a satisfying third act.
Yeah, we agree. We all agree it's not structured well, but it's still a spectacle. It's still something that, if we weren't in 4DX, we might have enjoyed more.
Oh, I really enjoyed it in 4DX.
I'm blaming.
I might actually be a masochist. Mick. Yeah.
I reckon a portion of your dislike comes from the fact that the seat just didn't stay still. You were being hit round the back of the head and the back of the legs and in the back repeatedly throughout the film and sprayed by water in the face. My God, it was like being in school all over again.
Hey, I'll tell you what.
I rumble shook about my Sword of Damocles too much. I didn't like it.
I'll tell you what. Alita was a lot more satisfying on 4DX than Three Billboards was.
Okay. Just the point I was making, though. The unknown manga, the stuff that's been out and forgotten, for example, stuff like Appleseed and things like that. Appleseed being an actual very interesting story, which is, it's got a lot of potential. On the back of Ghost in the Shell and Battle Angel Alita, I reckon Appleseed is probably what they're looking at next.
Yeah. This is why I, for one, think that Battle Angel, for all its flaws, is a decent stab at it. And I think possibly it may have just not quite hit the mark enough to draw people to the original piece. But I think it'll draw enough people in to get interest in, I don't know, what would you call it? Mangamar? Manga-based cinema. Mangamar. There we go. You heard it here first.
I think, in conclusion, here's to Alita Battle Angel. It's an upward trend, at least.
Yes, it is definitely an upward trend. I'm happy that it got made. I'm happy it got released.
We're going to take a break now.
Cool.
Cartoons, they're not just for kids anymore, except the ones that are actually for kids, they're for kids. If you liked that, then tune in to Keyframe for more scintillating insights about the world of animation. Part of the Geek Show's podcast network, we'll tell you whether it's as good as Ghibli or just plain giblets.
Hi everyone. My headphones aren't technically on my head right now, but apparently this is better for the mic. So whatever, we're talking about comics now. I hate this.
So yeah, this is a section where we tell you what we've been reading. And I've had my first exposure to Moon Knight.
You exposed yourself to Moon Knight?
I didn't expose myself to Moon Knight.
No, he got mooned.
I got mooned.
By Moon Knight?
By Moon Knight.
I
was unfamiliar with Moon
Knight. Now you're very familiar with Moon Knight.
No, I am not that familiar with Moon Knight. So this is Moon Knight issues 194 to 200, collected together into a story called Phases. And it is an odd fish, to say the least. It's written by Max Bemis and art by Ty Templeton, Jason Burrows, Paul Davidson, and a variety of inkers. So many inkers over the course of the six issues. So, I don't know what... He's like advanced Deadpool, is Moon Knight. But with the added complication that when he's talking to the voices in his head, they actually have physical representations. Is that about right?
Well, yeah, I suppose. Andrew?
One of which is a god.
Andrew?
Khonshu. Basically, they're like the interpretations of his different personalities that he sees in his mind, unless also they're actually real and Khonshu is a real god who has delivered him great power to protect the travels of the night.
Yeah.
Really, we probably shouldn't have started you off halfway through a Moon Knight run.
No. Although, Phases is given the byline of Mark Spector's True Origin Revealed.
I'm disappointed. Because I would have called it Phases Turn and Face the Strange.
Okay. But you're right, I have joined midway through a Moon Knight run, so much of this didn't actually make much sense. You know those little sort of previously bits that they do in these collected editions? Mark Spector recently fought through a gauntlet of enemies, old and new, as the Sun King joined with Bushman and the Truth to attempt to destroy Moon Knight and everything he held dear, including the daughter he never knew he had. Spectre overcame the odds and defeated the Sun King, but now faces an even greater challenge, fatherhood.
Oh yeah, that's the book I covered. You don't really, I probably should have been the one reviewing this run.
Yeah, this really confused me, this. So we start off with Moon Knight Origin, which starts off with Mark Spectre chatting with an old friend in a coffee shop, just chewing the fat as you do. And it goes back to a time when Mark was growing up in his Jewish community, and there was a rabbi.
A rabbi in a Jewish community?
Yeah, a rabbi who is, and I quote, the funniest guy that Mark Spector has ever met.
Hang on, it wasn't Krusty in his later years, was
it? No. Anyway, this story shows Mark growing up, sort of doing his dutiful learning of scripture and stuff like that. And every now and then he'll just go around to see his friend the rabbi. And one day he turns up and the old man is a little taken aback to see him, because he's in the middle of doing some kind of ceremony where he's hanging fellow Jews upside down in chains and bleeding them, in which we find that there is a Nazi rabbi. He's basically an undercover Nazi.
Wow.
That was my least favourite series of undercover boss.
And it's this traumatic discovery that this trusted leader of the community is actually a treacherous and murderous pig dog responsible for a Holocaust that apparently causes Mark to have his, shall we say, troubled personality. Wow. We then move.
Wow.
I don't think I like that.
Yeah. No. And I mean,
I don't like the idea that Mark Spector has these troubles because of some weird thing that happened to him. I preferred it when it was just his brain is wired a bit differently, and so this is a thing. You know, like real people who have mental illnesses.
Yeah.
Do you know what they've basically done? They've Highlander-2'd Moon Knight, haven't they? That's exactly what they've done. They didn't need to explain it, but they thought, no, we need to explain it in some way.
So then we move on, and we come back to the present, and we find a bunch of... Well, we find one wannabe supervillain who's decided that he wants to become a gestalt entity with other people. And he chooses some insanely strange individuals. There's Julie, who's an artist who's obsessed with human skulls of deceased circus clowns. There's Ty, who's an aggressive romantic nihilist. Samantha, who comes filled with self-doubt. And Peter, who's like a Facebook stalker who makes models of the people he's met out of papier-mâché before he meets them.
Awful hipster dinner party, isn't it?
It just seems like whoever wrote this just sat there and decided to play personality Scrabble.
Pretty much, yeah. So we then go through, and basically they find some old Hydra equipment and become a gestalt entity called the Collective, which it looks like some walking sick, basically, with faces. And the thing about the Collective is that it can absorb other people. It's like the Absorbaloff out of Doctor Who, Rob, if you remember.
Yeah, I remember it. It wasn't the best villain in Doctor Who, and it doesn't sound like the best villain here.
Guess what? This is the only Moon Knight comic I've ever read, and it's not the best villain I've seen Moon Knight come up against.
Is that the episode of Doctor Who where Mark Warren's girlfriend got turned into a paving slab?
That's the one.
Yep.
That wasn't a good episode of Doctor Who.
No, it wasn't.
No. And then there's a bizarre and surreal thing where Mark gets trapped in the Collective's mind and goes to various different areas of that mind, each different area representing a bit different aspect of the Collective's personality. You know, there's an airship with the Punisher logo on. There's Spider-Man iconography. There's a sort of robot Moon Knight, a sort of orcish Moon Knight.
So basically superheroes who we may or may not have met.
Well, it's almost like there are different versions of Moon Knight. There's one that appears to be some kind of, like, I don't know, vinyl pop dragon. There's one where he looks like he's kind of Luke Cage, but Moon Knight. And there's all these different aspects of additional personalities for Moon Knight. And it's one of those ones where you think, I don't know who's taking the most drugs, me or the person who wrote this, but I wish I'd taken more. And I don't do drugs.
Oh, do you recommend this or not?
I don't know. I think Andrew's got a good point in that he should maybe have done this one. I don't know enough about Moon Knight to know whether this is good Moon Knight or bad Moon Knight. But as an introduction to a hero, previous to this, my only exposure to Moon Knight was in the Marvel Lego games on Xbox, and he doesn't feature heavily in there. He's a sort of additional character. This version has not made me think, I need to get me more Moon Knight.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds like it's maybe building off a point, but it's a point that you don't know what it is.
Yeah. It's like walking at Twin Peaks at episode 4.
Wow.
And then trying to make some sense of it. I mean, to be fair, it's like walking into Twin Peaks from episode 1. You get my point.
Yeah, got your point. I mean, if you were reviewing this as Moon Knight, that'd be the perfect way to review it then. But only if you were reviewing it and playing the role of Moon Knight while you're reviewing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, see that Moon Knight fan film that someone put on YouTube?
I haven't seen that. Uh-huh.
It's not to besmirch the people, because I mean, just the fact that they've actually put the time and effort to make it in is quite impressive. But it's basically just Batman in a white costume.
Wow.
I don't get that from this.
Yeah. One time, Mark Spector was just Batman in a white costume. He was kind of Marvel's version of Batman. But then Marvel got a better version of Batman, didn't they, Andrew?
Did they?
Yeah, you know, the African-American dude who's like really rich and goes around dressed in a dark outfit fighting bad guys.
But Nighthawk sucks, Rob.
Is it Nighthawk? I'm getting confused between him and Darkhawk. There's too many hawks.
Yeah, no, Nighthawk is the guy. I mean, to be fair, like, the African-American Nighthawk is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's but who I'm on about.
Original flavor Nighthawk is the worst.
No, no, Vanilla Nighthawk is not the one I'm on about. I'm on about African-American. I'm on about...
You see, talking about African-American Nighthawk, Moonhawk, Nighthawk, and then calling the other one Vanilla, that sounded a little bit suspect.
Yeah, that's why I pulled back from the brink. I pulled back from the brink. Anyway.
The point here is, I didn't enjoy this, but I don't know whether that's because it's bad Moon Knight.
All right.
So I'm not going to turn around and say it's rubbish because I don't know enough. I don't have a frame of reference.
We'll get clarification off Andrew then.
Okay.
Right. Anyway, I'm going to Moon as well because I've got Moon Girl and the Marvel Universe, which it collects Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur numbers 24 and 31, Venom number 153, Monsters Unleashed number 12, and the Moon Girl Marvel Legacy Primer. And there's also material from Extraordinary X-Men Annual number 1. And it's got multiple authors. Do I have to go through them all? Please say no.
Yes. Yes, you do.
Damn you. Damn you all. Right. So, anyway, Moon Girl Legacy Primer is written by Robbie Thompson with art by...
Maybe just list all the creators involved.
All right, okay. All the creators involved from the back, I'm reading this. So I don't know whether they're writers or artists, so I'm just going to list them all. Brandon Moncler, Amy Reeder, Mike Costa, Justin Jordan, Robbie Thompson, Natasha Bustos, Ray Anthony, Height, Dominique Domo, Stanton, Michael Shelfer, Gerardo Sandoval, Alberto Albuquerque, Marco Fela, Tamara Bonvillain, Donna Sanchez-Almara, Chris Sotomayor, and Mike Spicer.
And if you want to know who did what, you can sod out yourselves, you filthy animals.
Yes. So anyway, this starts off with a brief couple of pages introduction to what's happened with Lunella Lafayette and how she became Moon Girl, met Devil Dinosaur, that sort of thing. Also a little bit about how her mind is now linked to Devil Dinosaurs, and once a month they will swap. And her body will be taken over by Devil Dinosaur, and she will be controlling the dinosaur. That's always fun when that happens, especially when it happens in odd places. So anyway, it starts off with the epilogue of a particular story arc called Girl Moon. And it's the story arc where she's lost her best friend. She's walked away from Devil Dinosaur. And she's trying to sort things out on her own. But somehow, she gets transported to Mojo TV, to Mojo's world, where she meets the baby X-Men, or the X-Babies, or whatever they're called. And Mojo has it in his head that he wants Lunella to lead a new team, and she will be a big hit. Everybody in Mojo World is already a huge fan of Moon Girl. There are people dressing like her. There are holograms of Devil Dinosaur all over the place, and Mojo wants to replace Devil Dinosaur with this new team, which basically include the X-Babies. Lunella's not having any of that, so he moves on to the next story, which is where Moon Girl is continuing to try and find a sidekick. And who does she go for? She takes a look at Ghost Rider, because that's logical. It's not, but it's still a hell of a lot of fun, because Ghost Rider is engaging in his annual race against another Ghost Rider who's riding a kid's tricycle, and a much older Ghost Rider who is riding a penny farthing.
Sure, fine, great.
I'm just going to ask a question now. Has the American government been doing experiments with LSD in the water supply again?
This is even more weird than Moon Knight. This is Moon Girl. And then after that, it's Moon Girl and Daredevil in a story called Blinds, where she ends up having to fight ninjas with Daredevil, and the ninjas want to kidnap her for some reason, but Daredevil stops them. That all ends with a picture of Moon Girl, and in front of her is obviously The Thing and Johnny Storm, and then you can pick up the story from there. But then you've got other stories. You've got the Venom story, which is where Devil Dinosaur is being controlled by some lizard scientist guy who lives underground and is in charge of a bunch of lizard people who live underground.
Is it Eglon the Dinosaur Man?
Yes.
Nice. He's a dinosaur man. Wants to turn everyone into dinosaurs.
Yep.
I don't know why he's considered a villain and not the world's greatest hero. Because why would you not want to be a dinosaur person?
Well, maybe it's because he hasn't actually done it. That's why he's a villain. Yeah. If he'd have succeeded, he'd have been a hero.
Yeah. But anyway, that basically ends up with Venom having to look after a bunch of underground dinosaur people and be their protector. Sucks to be Venom.
Lethal protector.
Yeah, lethal don't. Anyway, after that you have the Monsters Unleashed story, which has Kei Kawade and Lunella Lafayette. Basically, Kid Kaiju and Moon Girl are having a picnic.
Kid Kaiju.
Yeah.
Character who everyone knows and loves.
Yeah. They're having a picnic at the park, and while they're having a picnic at the park, Kid Kaiju has two of his monsters and Devil Dinosaur. The two monsters are Slizik and Hivor, and they're playing Frisbee with Devil Dinosaur and a manhole cover.
I mean, with a manhole cover.
Yeah.
But the manhole cover is, like, not one of the participants in the game of Frisbee.
No. The manhole cover is the Frisbee. But anyway,
terrible at catching.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, they're suddenly attacked by three robots who are led by a pink robot called Miss Mech. And she turns out to be basically the same as Kid Kaiju. I'm not even going to go into that because it's a pretty lame story. It's not very good. Just like the whole Monsters Unleashed.
Throwing that shade.
Yes, I am. Moving on to one of the penultimate, I think it's the penultimate story. It's called Forge, We Have a Problem. And this is the one where Lunella is building a rocket ship, and Forge is trying to help her, but he keeps telling her the rocket's not going to fly. They get attacked by a Terrigen Cloud, yada, yada, yada. Rocket has to fly. And then the final one is, I don't know whether this story is nonsense or not, because it has one of the more interesting villains who appear in this. When I say interesting, I mean in a ridiculous way.
Is it Swan the Bee Natty?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, us.
And you know,
Swarm the Bee Nazi.
Yeah, Swarm the Bee Nazi. He is made of bees.
He's and not, is a Nazi.
Yeah, he is not covered in bees. He's made of bees. And here's the thing. Somehow or other, we don't know how Lunella spends a portion of this trying to figure out, but people are becoming addicted to cigarettes. Oh no, the horror.
That could never happen, surely.
Oh no, it could never happen,
well,
surely.
Lunella, smartest person in the world, Lafayette.
Yeah.
Is trying to figure out why people are addicted to cigarettes.
Oh no, she figures out that it has something to do with bees, because what she's done, she's attached the world's smallest GPS harness to a bee and she's tracking it back to where it's going. And she finds Swarm, the bee Nazi, and he's saying that his bee army is going to grow bigger and stronger, and he's introduced a human-targeted neonicotinoid that renders all humans dependent on nicotine.
What?
Yeah, it's a chemical that basically...
Oh, it's like one of those like weird PSAs from the 60s.
Yeah, I know. Basically, neonicotinoid is one of those chemicals that's in insecticide. This seems like a PSA from that, but dressed up in the clothes of Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, although Devil Dinosaur doesn't wear clothes. But yeah, I will...
What if Devil Dinosaur did wear clothes, though?
It'd have to be...
Jacket.
No. Waistcoat, Devil Dinosaur with a waistcoat.
And a little bowler hat.
Yes.
Oh, that's a normal size bowler hat, but because he is a giant dinosaur, it looks little.
Yes. Moon Girl and the Marvel Universe is a lot of fun. I'd say if you've not read any Moon Girl and you just want a quick introduction, you want to quickly dip your toes into what Moon Girl is all about, then it's good for that. But if you're a regular reader of Moon Girl, then you're probably not going to bother with this, because you'll know most of these stories anyway.
That's more, it sounds like kind of one of those sort of definitive Platinum Edition things they do.
Yeah, it also lied to me. Because on the cover, it has the Silver Surfer and Galactus, but the gold version of Galactus, you know, where he's the Lifebringer.
Oh, yeah.
And neither of them appear.
That's odd. That's like, why would you choose that specific cover?
That's my point. Anyway, Andrew.
So after what is like, God, 4 years maybe? I've been reading Die Vergelder, Volume 2.
I think it's been about 2 years. No, actually, it's 3 years, sorry.
Yeah, that sounds, because I'm sure it was back when we had The Office that I read the first volume, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was.
So, yeah, if you don't remember, because you definitely don't, Die Vergelder is a manga from Hiroaki Samura, creator of Blade of the Immortal.
Yep.
It's really good with that last name, that he is the guy who created Blade of the Immortal, isn't it?
Yep. Blade of the Immortal's fairly messed up, but in good ways.
Speaking of, this is a series about three women who need to take down a corrupt German pharmaceutical company which is working with the Yakuza to turn an island into a red light district by infiltrating the island by pretending to be prostitutes and then getting in big kung fu fights, and also one of them's a cyborg. So, and she can twist men's faces off.
So it's basically Charlie's Angels done violently right.
Actually, that's 70s exploitation Charlie's Angels.
Wow.
Is probably the perfect way of explaining what this series is. Like, mixed with a lot of old school kung fu movies.
Still exploitation movies. They did a lot of kung fu in those movies. Or what they thought was kung fu anyway.
No, I mean, this is specifically kind of Bruce Lee-esque kung fu. Because I like that there's a sort of creator's note in the back of one of these, and afterward in the back of one of these volumes, where Hiroaki explains his just a noble goal for creating this series, which is, how come all the modern kung fu stuff is about this practical martial arts? What happened to all the really ridiculous, flashy, over-the-top stuff? That's all that.
Hey, he's got a point.
It's true.
So I guess it's like, it's the push for realism now, isn't it? It's like stuff you could actually use to win a fight.
Yeah.
But rather than G Mao, a character in this, who is an assassin who has taser shoes and gun chucks.
Wow. See,
gun jokes.
I love that.
Gun jokes.
That's just an amazing idea, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like the most wildly impractical thing I've ever seen, but it's also cool as hell.
And makes more sense than Bayonetta's gun shoes, isn't it?
I will not have a word said against Bayonetta.
Only because you like her.
I mean, look, I suppose in this series' favour, it is slightly more realistic than Bayonetta is.
Yeah, but Bayonetta, because video games. That's the only way to explain Bayonetta.
So anyway, this series is still real good, guys. Like, Volume 3 is almost entirely just one massive fight. Because basically, the ladies, Shinobu, Nami, and Soli, come across sort of a quote-unquote family who are living basically under the assumed names of Shinobu's dead family. And, like, there's one guy who is Korean and has, like, a weird gold face mask, and also wields a giant, essentially, like, a giant razor, like what you would shave your face with, but shaves people's entire heads off.
And are we on about, like, the barber's razors? Are we on about, like, a Gillette or something like that?
Yeah, basically, like, just a big Gillette. A big Gillette. And his wife, who is an Indian woman, who I can't remember the name, but she uses some kind of ridiculous, like, dance martial arts, and also spends about half the volume just on fire.
What?
Yeah, she gets set on fire. That doesn't stop her.
So hang on, she uses some weird. Is it one of those dance martial arts like in the like they do in the Bollywood movies where they have to look from behind a tree? And then when it's raining, or, you know, when there's a celebration, hundreds of them appear out of thin air.
Oh, no, you joke, Rob, but yes. Those are entirely just like Bollywood dance things.
Oh, I've got to read this.
Yeah, you also have a new character who joins the ladies, who might be one of my new favourite characters. He's a guy named Aisuke, who is basically... So, to go into the plot a bit, there's three different factions of Yakuza. There's, for all intents and purposes, the good Yakuza that Shinobu and the others work for.
Yeah.
Bad Yakuza, who are working with the pharmaceutical company. And then the Yakuza branch that Aisuke is part of, who are basically, like, the parent group of the bad guys. And so he's kind of investigating just what the heck's going on. But also, he makes... friends with Soli, and by friends I mean, I think the official explanation he gives is, "I'm her horse."
Okay.
I mean, don't worry, it's very specifically not sexual. Because see, the mafia group that Soli works for, she's their head torturer, and turns out Aisuke's really into that.
Wow.
Like, there's basically this really dark joke at the start where she's at the brothel, kind of looking through the equipment, just going, "Nah, these whips are too soft. What are these low heat candles? Brah." So what she does is, when the John is tied to the chair, she gets the equipment used to fix the toys and just, like, takes down a painting in the room, pulls all the nails out, and says, "Right. You're my horse, and first thing that horses need is to be shooed."
Wow.
I mean, it's basically that, and then Nami defeats Gillette Man by using her cyborg plasma cutter hand to cut down a tree on him. And that's basically Devengelder in a nutshell.
It sounds like you had a lot of fun with this.
It is, because it's just, it's a series that's constantly at 11. And yeah, also, I like that there's a nice mix of, because this is sort of a deluxe edition, which has got volume 3 and 4 in it.
Yeah.
And I like that volume 3 is, like, pretty much just one big action sequence. And then you've got volume 4 that delves more into the story. You find out a lot more about the characters' backstories. Find out that lots of them are related to each other in unexpected ways.
Oh, right. That's surprising.
And we also get to find out the backstory for one of possibly the most WTF moments in the first volume, which is that there's a character who's literally just a freaking mermaid.
Okay.
Like, she's the top half of a woman, bottom half of a fish.
I was a bit worried where that was going because this is the Bag Elder.
Yeah, it could very easily be the other way around.
Everybody's least favourite kind of mermaid.
We laugh, but actually her backstory is really sad and messed up. Like, super messed up to that I don't think there's a single bit I can actually mention on the show without a special E next to it.
Wow.
But it's also interesting because it ties into sort of idea that there's a lot of grey and grey morality going on. So, like, the Hill Minor Corporation, they're the bad pharmaceutical group, and they're very evil. Their heads are like literally cannibals who are eating people's body parts to try and live forever. But also it's revealed that a lot of the places they're going to these like poor, like downtrodden, poverty-stricken areas. And like, sure, they're basically turning them into red light districts and running all kinds of illegal experiments, but they're also making them really profitable. Like, because I like, it's what like G Mao's motivation is for working for them. She's like, I don't approve of what they're doing, but like the places they go, the people aren't starving to death anymore, and maybe that's worth it.
It's weird because there is a logic to it.
Yeah, which I like that it's, you've got heroes who have fairly noble goals, but are also like Yakuza thugs and assassins and people who like to tie all the candles in the hotel together and just pour the whole thing of molten wax onto someone's stomach. And then, like, the bad guys who are cartoonishly evil, but are also doing some things that are kind of good. Like, they give people new leases on life.
Wow. Complex.
It is. And then Gunchuck Taserfeet has to fight a capoeira man.
I see, Gunchuck Taserfeet just sounds like the new addition to Tekken or something like that.
I mean, she is basically Tekken. The main takeaway I got from this was it's kind of almost like a fighting game in that a lot of the story seems to be introducing these new characters who each have their own like distinct styles and fight moves. Like you could easily make a Duvet Gelda fighting game.
Now you've said that, someone probably will.
Yeah, someone's probably already working on it.
Also, one last thing. Do you know the weirdest thing about this series is?
What?
The stuff you've talked about already isn't the weirdest bit.
Yeah, I mean, for an exploitation book in which most of the characters are either prostitutes or pretending to be, it's actually quite restrained with the fan service.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about manga in general. The more mature and extreme a story is, the less it plays around with fan service.
Yeah, because I think it's like, it's comfortable enough to say, hey, do you want some attractive ladies? There's some attractive ladies, knock yourself out.
Yeah.
Instead of the, I feel like a lot of the more kid-friendly manga, it's like a world where sex doesn't exist.
Yeah, the teenage, so, the stuff aimed at teenagers.
Exactly. It's like all the busty teenagers. It just feels a bit creepy and voyeuristic, doesn't it?
Well, that's all the shonen manga, I suppose you'd call it. What you're reading is basically seinen, so it's aimed at adults in the first place. Battle Angel Lita, for example, is a seinen manga.
Okay, also, but can we circle back to Battle Angel Lita for a sec? Because I remember one of my other complaints.
Oh.
Did either of you two have a moment where you sat there and you're watching Lita have this nice heartwarming conversation with Christoph Waltz and you just suddenly think, she's naked?
Yeah.
Because she's... Why is the robot body so busty?
I don't know, but I didn't have that moment of realisation. I just sat there and watched the film whilst having my back pummeled to death.
The truth is starting to come out now, Andrew.
I bet Mick would get shooed. Shooed like a horse.
I think you'll find the phrase is shod.
Yes, shod.
Aha, that proves it.
Anyway, Mick, what you got for us?
Yeah. Talking about Duvet Gelda for far too long.
I have Deadpool. Merkin hard for the money. Do you see what they've done there?
I had my foot up while I was talking about Dvergelda, and now it's gone to sleep. Continue.
So, Merkin Hard for the Money is a collection of Deadpools number 1-6, written by Scotty Young and illustrated by Nick Klein and Scott Hepburn.
Oh, good, because I was going to say, it said it collects Deadpool 1-6, does not narrow it down.
I know. That's why I went with the credits there.
That's the current series. I like that.
Yeah, so I'll be honest, I had mixed anticipation about this, because obviously, on the one hand, it's Deadpool, what's not to like? But on the flip side, I'm not a huge fan of Scotty Young, but that's because the only thing I'm familiar with is his variant covers.
Oh, so you've actually read anything he's written?
No.
You haven't read I Hate Fairyland?
I tried, but I don't think I knew enough about what it was doing to actually appreciate it, if that makes sense. Probably not, judging by the silence.
It does make sense.
Things you say very rarely do.
So, the thing is, this has won me round, because I really, really enjoyed this. There's sometimes you read a Deadpool series and it's wacky because it's Deadpool, but it's being wacky for wacky's sake. Whereas this is one of those times when the writing actually really gets Deadpool.
Yeah, plus I think it might be what you're saying is a lot of people write wacky Deadpool stories because they think that's the kind of story Deadpool needs.
Yeah.
But this is what I'm saying. I'm Scotty Young. I like writing wacky stories. Deadpool lets me do that.
Yeah. This actually could be a comic book featuring any of the Marvel Universe. It just works well because it's Deadpool in it. But you could... The adventure itself, apart from that little excursion into Weird World, the actual adventure itself isn't that weird for a Marvel comic. So,
yeah, I get what you mean.
Yeah. So it starts off, as all the best stories do, in a cinema. And Wade is watching a film, whilst he's also supposed to be taking out a client's target. And this is setting the scene for the fact that Deadpool is in the Merkin business following a memory wipe, and he's got an office that's run by that most calm and organised of secretaries, Teenage Negasonic Warhead, with her usual respect for her boss, the kind of respect you'd expect her to hold for Deadpool. And it turns out that business ain't that great, and Deadpool starts pondering that this may be because he hasn't got a sympathetic enough origin story, which then leads on to some of the funniest reworkings and parodies of famous superhero origins ever. But my particular favourite, and I know, Andrew, you've read this series, my particular favourite is the Batman origin story, retold.
Jeff, I've got to admit, I don't remember this issue that well.
Well, this is right at the end of issue one. And up to now, we've had a reimagining of the Hulk origin. We've had a reimagining of Superman. We've had a reimagining of Spider-Man. I think there's even a reimagining of Fantastic Four or something. But basically, there's three or four. And then it finishes off with a young boy heading home after going to see a film with his parents. They're walking down an alley. They get mugged. Pearl necklace falls to the floor. The young boy is there crying in the alley.
Oh, I remember where this is going.
And it turns out this isn't a reimagining of an origin story. This is just a memory of Wade's. I won't spoil the ending of it, but it just is awesome. And then we get on to the real crux of the story arc. The Guardians of the Galaxy get in touch with the Avengers to warn them of a cataclysmic danger that's heading towards Earth. One of the Celestials has broken through into this dimension, hell-bent on destruction. And it turns out that only one man can save the Earth from the onslaught. And that's Deadpool.
What's Deadpool's costume like at this point, Mick?
Well, it's fairly standard Deadpool ish. You know, you've got that red motif with the black eye patches and the stuffed toy underwear.
I love the stuffed toy underwear.
Yeah. And that's a gag that runs through the entire story arc as well. And what I like about this is that during the story arc, as we find out that this gun that somehow is in Deadpool's possession and is the only thing that can stop this cataclysmic invasion happening, when Deadpool does his normal sort of fourth wall breaking, he even pokes fun at the cartoony covers that Scotty Young does. Anyway, there's a twist to this arc with this cataclysmic event, which again, I won't spoil. But needless to say, later, events take us into Weird World. And this is a mission where Teenage Negasonic and Hydra Bob accompany Deadpool into the Bermuda Triangle. And in order to get his mark, Deadpool has to enter Weird World.
It's a world that's weird.
That's right. And lots of weird things happen. There's lots of wars. There's a sequence where Wade makes a friend, he makes a new enemy, he makes another friend, and then he breaks up with his friend. This is all the same guy, it should be said, and I suspect possibly takes place during the course of one night. And there's a scene where Deadpool gets confronted by not one, not two, but what appears to be a family of man-things.
Which I'm surprised they'd allow that in a Marvel comic.
Yes, but they did. And so it's a standard superhero comic book story as you can get with Deadpool, but it works because it is Deadpool in it. And it finishes off, and I know we've mentioned this on the show before, and I think this was at the time when you were reading the series individual issues.
The official new villain find of 2019, I think, when this happened,
because on the heels of last year's revelation of Filsome Whisk, you've now got Killpuddle, the laughing assassin.
I love that whole issue of Deadpool like being really down in the dumps.
Yeah,
and the only thing that can bring him out of it is learning that there's a man running around called Killpuddle.
Yep,
it's a good series.
It is a good series. There's lots of little cameos from the Avengers and the Defenders and various other Marvel staples. There's a Halloween walkathon taking place in a mall where Deadpool's having bets with one of the mall cops. And that's just bizarre and wild and just gets wilder and wilder and wilder. So, yeah, it's a really good and enjoyable series. And it's one of the better Deadpool ones. It doesn't feel like it's just trying to fill a gap that there hasn't been a Deadpool series for a while. It seems like this is a story that's been brewing for a while, and they just wanted to do it as a Deadpool comic. And I, for one, I'm glad they did.
Yeah, I would also recommend you should read Scotty Young's Rocket Raccoon because it is very similar.
Cool.
Yeah, that's good, and I think that's probably all we have time for this week.
It is, because you guys dragged on so much.
Well, fear not, Rob. You'll get to talk about whatever nonsense you've got next week.
Vikings.
Fine, you'll get your Vikings on our fairly regular review blowout spectacular. Okay, we've got so many comics.
Yeah, I know.
Comics, we need to get through them.
I know. Right, so if you want to catch up with all of our episodes, you'll find them on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, or you can find them on Audioboom or Apple Podcasts, or whichever podcast provider you're listening through. If you are listening through one of those services, then leave us a rating, leave us a review. It does help us improve, and it does help with our exposure as well.
Or just leave a comment. Tell us, what did you think of Alita Battle Angel?
Yes, that would be... Yeah, we are interested in finding out.
Yeah, did you like it, or do you have the correct opinion? I'm kidding. I can see why people like it, and good on them.
I'm happy it was made, like I said.
It's an anime adaptation that is not completely terrible.
Ghost in the Shell was an anime adaptation, a manga adaptation, whatever you want to call it, that wasn't completely terrible.
But also, I haven't seen that one.
Thing is, Ghost in the Shell suffered from being called Ghost in the Shell. If it was called something else, you know, like Cyborg Sue or something like that, then it wouldn't have, I reckon it would have done so much better.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think if it had been either renamed and not, I think there was an expectation amongst people who do know manga and anime because it was called Ghost in the Shell. I think it set a level of expectation. I'm very much the same as any Western comic book adaptation does. You know, Batman's a popular property.
Yeah.
So there's a level of expectation on a Batman movie.
So if you want to leave, we're done.
Anyway,
we'll still be when you come back.
Yeah. We'll continue this next time, but until the next episode, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
We'll see you all later.
And thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.